Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 9th of July, these are our main stories. The US President Joe Biden tells Democrats to unite behind him, vowing he will stand in November's election. International condemnation after a Russian strike hits a children's hospital in Kyiv. In Kenya, the leader of a doomsday cult goes on trial. Also in this podcast, plane maker Boeing is ordered to urgently inspect thousands of oxygen masks and...
At the moment, the amount of people playing padel compared to tennis is hugely, hugely different. And I think there's room for all racket sports.
A battle between racket games as tennis great Novak Djokovic says the future of his sport could be under threat from padel. We start this podcast in the United States, where President Biden says he isn't going anywhere as he seeks to unite the Democratic Party ahead of the US election in November. The last few weeks of the campaign have divided the party, causing some colleagues to call on the 81-year-old president to drop out of the race. In an open letter to lawmakers, he stressed his ability to run and his commitment to defeating Donald Trump. And Mr. Biden repeated that message in an interview with MSNBC.
The bottom line here is that we're not going anywhere. I am not going anywhere. I wouldn't be running if I didn't absolutely believe that I am the best candidate to beat Donald Trump in 2024. We had a Democratic nominating process where the voters spoke clearly. I won 14 million of those votes, et cetera. So I not only believe that from the beginning, but I wanted to reassert and demonstrate that it's true. And I'm going to be doing that all through this week and from here on.
The BBC's US partner, CBS News, is reporting that later the president reassured donors in a phone call that he is staying in the race. Our North America correspondent, Anthony Zerker, told me more about the letter to congressional Democrats.
That letter was an attempt to head off what is going to be conversations that are taking place in the Capitol as Democratic lawmakers head back to Washington after their 4th of July recess and begin meeting face to face and having discussions about what to do about Joe Biden and whether to increase the pressure to get him to stand aside. That letter directly targeted Democratic lawmakers and essentially made the case in Joe Biden's view on why he should still be the nominee and why he is not stepping aside. He said that he was the best positioned to defeat Donald Trump. He said also that he was the selected nominee during an open Democratic presidential primary process earlier this year, and that to move away from him would be to deny the voices of millions of Democratic voters. That how can the Democratic Party be the party of democracy and democratic values if they throw out the legitimate votes cast by Democratic citizens and said now is the time after a week of concerns and complaints that he has heard, he says, but now is the time for Democrats to get together because he's not getting out of the race and unite so that they can defeat Donald Trump. So it was a several-page letter, and it laid out point by point about why Joe Biden's not going anywhere and why Democrats need to move on from this.
Is this enough, do you think?
It's going to be a challenging week for Joe Biden. He is hosting the NATO summit here over the next few days in Washington, D.C. He has a press conference, his first in months. He is going to be under a microscope for the next few days. Every action is going to be unpacked and analyzed. If he can get through this week, if he can get through that press conference, that might be enough. But in the end, really, no matter how much pressure there is on Joe Biden, he has the decision lies in his hands. As he points out, he has the delegates. He could get through these next few weeks, get to the convention and be the nominee unless he decides to stand aside.
And if there's going to be a change, it has to be, hasn't it, at the convention. After that, it is a done deal.
After that, it is a done deal. And it may even have to be before the convention, because the Democrats had been planning on doing the nuts and bolts of the nomination process, where the delegates vote for the next nominee, doing that virtually weeks before that end of August Democratic convention. So I think the people who oppose Joe Biden, who think the party would be better off going in a different direction, they understand that something has to happen in the next 2 weeks. And if it doesn't, at that point, it may be too late to have any kind of an orderly process. So this week, next week, really are going to be determinative on whether Joe Biden can continue.
Anthony Zerka. There has been international condemnation after a wave of Russian missiles struck five Ukrainian cities, killing more than 30 people. One strike hit the Okhmadit Children's Hospital in the capital Kyiv, leaving at least two dead. Emergency services spent much of Monday going through the rubble, and children, many of them with cancer, were taken out onto the open street, with medics fearing for their safety. The strikes happened on the eve of a NATO summit, where military support for Ukraine will be a major point of discussion. NATO's Jens Stoltenberg described them as heinous attacks.
In Ukraine, Russia continues its brutal war. Only today we have seen horrendous missile attacks against Ukrainian cities, killing innocent civilians, including children. I condemn these heinous attacks. At the summit, we'll make decisions to further strengthen our support to Ukraine, and Russia must understand that they're not able to wait those out.
James Waterhouse has more from Kyiv.
Every few months or so, there is a searing image which breaks the grueling rhythm of Russia's invasion. Young cancer patients sitting outside the partially destroyed Okhmadit Children's Hospital in Kyiv was a horrific illustration of how Moscow's relentless missile strikes don't discriminate. It's where Lysia Lyskecha works as a doctor.
The biggest part of the hospital, it's not totally destroyed, but it's really very damaged, near 60 or probably 70% of the hospital. We are all involved in the process of evacuation patients in the nearest hospital, just trying not to worsen their condition. Majority part of these patients, they cannot go outside. It's not so easy to evacuate patients who are intubated and ventilated after liver or kidney transplantation.
Rescue teams are still trying to get to people who've been buried under the rubble. Medics in their green scrubs joined the effort. One of around 40 Russian missiles struck here in an aerial attack on several Ukrainian cities. Oleksandr Merezenko is an MP and chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Ukrainian Parliament.
I've been to such cities as Kherson, which is not far from frontline, and each hospital was, including also their children's hospital, was deliberately targeted.
He says the hospital was not a coincidence, because he said Russia had targeted other hospitals. He said it was a message from Moscow to NATO ahead of its summit in Washington this week, where ongoing military support for Ukraine will be discussed. The EU has accused Russia of ruthlessly targeting civilians. The UN Security Council is to meet to discuss the attack. President Zelensky has promised to retaliate.
I would like to hear from our partners a greater resilience and a stronger response to the blow that Russia has once again delivered on our population, on our land, on our children. And here you should not wait for me, you should wait for our partners. We will respond to these people. We will respond to Russia in a powerful way on our part, for sure. The question for our partners is whether they can respond.
And with his forces now able to hit some targets inside Russia with Western weapons, he can afford to be hawkish. His more nervous allies will be hoping that doesn't mean an escalation in long-range strikes.
James Waterhouse. A court in Moscow has sentenced two prominent theatre personalities to 6 years in jail each for justifying terrorism. Their arrest and subsequent trial sent shockwaves through Russia's artistic community. Sasha Schlichter reports.
Phineas the Brave Falcon was first performed in Moscow in 2021. It tells the story of Russian women who travelled to Syria during its civil war to marry IS jihadists they'd met online. The following year, the play received two of Russia's most prestigious theatre awards. But after Russia attacked Ukraine, the situation changed. A group of Kremlin-appointed experts concluded that the plague glorified terrorists, making them appear interesting and attractive to girls and women, while portraying Russian men in a negative light. Director Zhenya Berkovich and playwright Svetlana Petrychuk were arrested in May last year. On Monday, a judge in a military court found they'd been justifying terrorism and sentenced each to 6 years behind bars. An expert for the prosecution, called to the stand in May, said Phineas the Brave Falcon contained the ideology of radical feminism, which he linked to the conscious preparation and execution of terrorist acts. The case has been closely followed by the Russian-speaking artistic community, who saw it as a test of the limits of artistic freedom.
Sasha Schlichter. In Kenya, the leader of a doomsday cult has gone on trial in Mombasa over the deaths of more than 400 of his followers. Paul Nthengi Mackenzie, who was arrested in April last year, allegedly incited his acolytes to starve to death in order to meet Jesus, in a case which has attracted international attention. Richard Kagawe, our Africa regional editor, who's in Kenya, gave him more details.
The man is accused of a couple of charges. Actually, in total, we're looking at four, and which he has denied. So he's being charged with murder, with manslaughter, with terrorism, and with child abuse. But he's pleaded not guilty. Basically, he's alleged to have radicalized his followers because he's a controversial preacher. His church had all the hallmarks of a cult. And what he did is that he taught his followers that the only way that they would meet with Jesus is actually if they would have starved themselves to death. And we have close to about 400 people who lost their lives in the process.
And he isn't the only person on trial, is he?
Absolutely. He's got co-defendants, so looking at 94 of them, including his wife.
So tell us about the people who died.
Largely, these were men, children and women who actually made up the majority of them. These were people from poor backgrounds, the people who were literally seeking for help. They were desperate and they were looking for opportunities on anything that actually would improve their lives. But then, of course, you would have pockets of people in there who are professionals. One of the most notable was a young girl who was in her 20s and was an air hostess working for a Middle East airline. So you'd have this mix of people that were involved in this cultic following.
And I mean, where was this happening?
So this was happening in a coastal town in southeastern Kenya, a place called Kilifi County. It's a very remote area. So actually where much of the church's activity was taking place is a remote forest called Shakahola Forest. It's next to a very big game reserve in that area. The church didn't have typical, you know, structures, say maybe like a cathedral or an auditorium of sorts. There were people who were just setting up small houses, which are basically semi-permanent structures. And that's where they would be having the religious activities away from prying eyes.
And what about those who survived this? What's happened to them?
Those are just some of the people who are now being called up as witnesses for this hearing. A lot of them have had to go through rehabilitation, you know, go through psychosocial support in the process of just rehabilitating them after really going through such a very traumatic experience. A lot of them, because of this experience, have been very fearful, actually, to speak out even in public and just recount the experiences. So that's why we've had some of the relatives who've been bold enough who have just come and, you know, said exactly what their kin went through.
And, Richard, how much interest is this case attracting in Kenya, where you are?
Wow, this has really generated lots of interest, and especially for the most part of last year, and really lift the lead to the extent to which some of these very rogue religious leaders would go just to radicalize their followers. So it's created a lot of debate, and there's been calls even for regulation of religious organizations in the country.
Richard Kagawe in Nairobi. You're listening to the Global News Podcast with me, Valerie Sanderson. Still to come, what now for France after no party claimed a majority in parliamentary elections? And
Jesus Christ is depicted reaching out to a band of his followers with a crucifix in the background. What's different about this work, though, is that Jesus' face is replaced with Goofy's face.
A painting depicting Jesus as a cartoon character has caused a stir in Sydney.
We're in the El Garbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
On the previous edition of the Global News podcast, we reported that the plane maker Boeing will pay a $243 million fine. That's related to two fatal crashes of Boeing 737 MAX planes that killed 346 passengers and crew. Now, more issues for the embattled company have emerged. American regulators have ordered urgent inspections into thousands of 737 planes over fears that the passenger oxygen masks on board could be faulty. I spoke to our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore.
The concern is that these masks could fail in the case of an emergency. And so regulators have ordered the inspection of 2,600 airplanes. And to be more specific about it, the Federal Aviation Administration is requiring that operators check these passenger air masks, the ones that are supposed to come down in an emergency if the plane cabin pressure depressurizes, to make sure that they haven't shifted out of position. And that, if they're not in position, could potentially leave passengers without access to the masks in an emergency.
Now, this is just the latest in a string of issues from Boeing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it feels like they've been coming one after another since January, when we saw the door plug blow out of a flight operated by Alaska Airlines during the flight in January. And the reason why that was so significant is because at the time, Boeing was in a bit of a probation period stemming from two fatal crashes back in 2018 and 2019 that killed 346 people. And so questions have arisen about how far Boeing has come from then until now to shore up its own safety record and quality control issues. There were no deaths or fatalities in that January incident, but it did bring Boeing's safety record back into the spotlight.
And how will this affect Boeing going forward?
Boeing seems to be facing criticism from all sides at this point. It's not just when we see the CEO of the company, Dave Calhoun, stepping in front of Congress and being grilled by lawmakers. It also comes from regulators, not only the FAA, but the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board. And it comes from the airlines themselves, who have been hesitant to order more planes from Boeing. And it comes from the traveling public, who now hear about these stories and feel anxiety about the flights that they have. So certainly Boeing has had a rough few months. You can see it even if you go back and look at how their stock price has shifted since January, down about 25%.
Erin Delmore. France is emerging from election results that have caused a political earthquake in the country. The vote in the second round of snap parliamentary elections was split three ways among the far right, the centre and broad left. Although the left got the most votes, no bloc has come close to a majority, which means the next few weeks will involve some delicate negotiation and compromise. President Emmanuel Macron has asked his Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, to stay in the role for now, after Mr. Macron's centrist alliance only managed second place. Mr. Attal had offered his resignation. Our correspondent, Mark Lowen, travelled to a town south of Paris that turned out to be the political bellwether of France.
Here at the Bureau Brasserie in Bretigny-sur-Orge, just south of Paris, minds are on victory. Not political, but sporting. The French flags are out, the TVs are on, as they gear up for France's Euro 2024 semi-final against Spain. But while the country will come together for the match, it's been deeply divided by the election. This constituency mirrored the picture across France, the far-right National Rally winning here in the first round, but then the opposition uniting to stop them in the second, backing the left. Sami Debal is the manager here.
I have Algerian origins. A big part of the National Rally program was anti-immigration, anti-Muslim. I couldn't accept ideas that would be against half of my family. Everybody woke up after the first round and went out to vote left to block the far right, and I'm very relieved.
Well, the steaks and burgers are sizzling away here in the kitchen, topped with eggs and cheese for the lunchtime rush. This was an area where the third-placed candidate from the first round, from President Macron's centrist coalition, dropped out to unite behind the left. a tactic that worked across the country. But there's still support for the far right from customers like Elisa Robet.
I'm disappointed. I wanted the National Rally to win. They defend French identity. And there's a lot of crime here. The party wants to crack down on that. It's why they're so supported in this area. I still have hope that one day we'll have a national rally government.
As the exit poll came through, there was stunned silence at the National Rally HQ. The chance of a first far-right government since the Second World War thwarted at the 11th hour. But Stefan Milosevic, the defeated rally candidate here in Bretigny, tried to put a positive spin on it.
It's not a defeat for us. I think we fight really well in these elections. Il s'agissait d'une alliance entre...
This alliance between the losing parties stole this election from the French people. 70% of the French are in favour of reducing immigration. We are patriots. We just want people to respect our identity and culture. Our victory is just delayed.
But it's a victory now for the left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front. There were cheers and tears of relief as their numbers came through. But without an overall majority for the left, political commentator Sylvie Kaufmann says there's still little clarity.
This is an unprecedented situation in France, in the Fifth Republic. This is really the first time it has happened. So can we learn the art of compromise, which is so unusual for us? I hope so. The left program is not acceptable to all other forces in parliament, so they will have to negotiate, and so far it's very difficult to see how they will achieve this.
In the park in Bretigny, after-school playtime for families is a release from election tensions. But the next generation is growing up in a country that feels polarised, unsure of its future. The far right may have been held off here and across France, but with each election it gets closer to power. And the National Rally is playing the long game, waiting for next time.
Mark Lowen reporting. An artwork depicting Jesus with his followers overlaid with faces of cartoon characters has been removed from an art gallery in Sydney. It came after a torrent of online abuse was aimed against staff at the gallery and local city council. The incident raises all sorts of questions about freedom of speech and religious sensibilities. Helena Burke is a former correspondent for ABC Australia, and she spoke to Rachel Wright.
The painting first went on display in Western Sydney about 2 months ago now, and it was part of an exhibition that encouraged artists to explore spirituality and religion through their art. For the artists of the painting, Phil James, that's exactly what he'd believed he'd done. The artwork looks like a typical Renaissance-era biblical oil painting. Jesus Christ is depicted reaching out to a band of his followers with a crucifix in the background. What's different about this work, though, is that Jesus' face is replaced with Goofy's face, the cartoon dog. Some of Jesus' followers have had their faces replaced as well with what looks to be Daffy Duck and potentially one of the seven dwarves. We've also got Sylvester the cat in the painting, and you can see his bottom as he dives under Jesus' robe.
And what did the artist want to do with this? Does he say, do we know what he was intending?
We haven't heard much from the artist. We know that the local council who decided to remove the painting said that he had supported their decision and been understanding about it. But we can assume from sort of what was instructed about the exhibition that it was about sort of exploring religion and making a comment on spirituality.
And of course, not everybody liked it. There were a lot of objections. Tell us about that.
That's right. So Liverpool Council, which is the local council where the gallery was, said they received a lot of complaints, particularly from Christian and Muslim groups. And ultimately, that's why they'd made the decision to remove it. And what one of the Christian groups had written online was that Christ shouldn't be mocked and depicted as the cartoon character Goofy or Daffy Duck.
And is that the reason why it was removed?
That is what they've said. They've sort of explained that you need to balance, or at least from their perspective, you need to balance the right to free speech with the right to practice your religion without persecution or ridicule. They also said, I'll read out this quote to you, quote, "The Christian Messiah and the Muslim Messiah, Jesus, has no connection to the cartoon character Goofy."
Helena Burke. While tennis fans from all over the world are focused on the Wimbledon tournament here in England, one of the sport's biggest stars, Novak Djokovic, says tennis may be under threat from a different kind of racket game. Well, paddle is a racket sport that's gaining in popularity. Stephanie Prentice is a regular paddle player and explained to me how the game is played and why it's so popular.
This is a fast-paced game. It's really fun. It's taken off particularly among younger people. That clip was one of thousands on TikTok. And that noise that we heard, that comes from the bat. It's quite hard and thick rather than a racket, and the ball is actually a little bit softer than a tennis ball. I guess the easiest way to understand this is the gameplay is tennis meets squash. So we've got a shorter court, the net's in the middle, and the players, if you imagine, are using all four of the walls like you would in squash, because you can hit it off the side of the wall. Now, it's primarily a doubles game. In that sense, it's seen as more sociable. You're in closer proximity to the other players, and the clubs tend to have things like music playing and bars within the space. Now, it is accessible to anyone with a knowledge of tennis, so the scoring system is the same, but dare I say, it is easier to play. I go to Paddle Social Club in London. Just before we came on air, I spoke to its owner, Christian.
Paddle has seen as an attractive proposition within the commercial world of sport. More paddle courts can fit into a smaller space. I think also because you're splitting the cost between four people, it makes it more affordable per person. And finally, there's the additional element outside of paddle, which is where we've positioned our business as a sort of social club.
So what Christian just touched on, really, that was part of Novak Djokovic's arguments. He said on a club level, this can be more viable for businesses. It's more accessible. It's more affordable. The suggestion being that that grassroots adoption of a game is what eventually keeps it alive.
And how popular is it? Is it something that more and more people are getting into? I mean, does it appeal to all age groups, do you think?
It's really popular. I mean, it started in Mexico in the 60s. It's been really popular there. It boomed in Spain. It's the second most popular sport there. We've seen celebrities like David Beckham playing and Stormzy, and that's really driven interest on it. In fact, the International Paddle Federation estimates around 25 million people compete worldwide currently. Now, Tia Norton is one of them. She's the UK's top female player. We asked her whether paddle can displace tennis, as Djokovic suggested.
At the moment, the amount of people playing paddle compared to tennis is hugely, hugely different. And I think there's room for all racket sports. There was actually a study to show that within 15 minutes of paddle and 15 minutes of tennis, there's a lot more paddle actually played. Paddle rallies, they vary a lot. And I think tennis rallies do as well, but depends what the spectator wants.
So as it stands, still a bit of a David and Goliath when it comes to paddle versus tennis. But as Tia was saying, it does really have a unique appeal. And in fact, experts are predicting it could be given the green light in the Olympics as early as 2032.
Reporter and indeed paddle player Stephanie Prentice. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Sean Wales. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.